it's hard to even look at as a whole, the British Empire. Like, what are, like, how do you even wrap your head around it? Like, from the, just the experiences in Ireland of the 19th century, of the mid-19th century, right? And the, what they call the Great Hunger, stretching from the dozens, possibly hundreds of famines induced, artificially induced in South Asia and India to, you know, everywhere else. I mean, the clear cutting of the forests of Turtle Island, right? I mean, this is ecological genocide, not to mention the actual human genocide that coincided and continues, right, in the form of settler colonial politics.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kallik, and this is Dispatches. Lately, it seems like the U.S. can't impose itself on the global South the way it used to. Whether with the Iran nuclear deal, or isolating Latin American countries from Venezuela and Cuba, or getting the world on board with its Russia sanctions. It appears, both at home and abroad, to be an empire in decline. Speaking of empires in decline, the sun has finally set on the last living vestige of the now dead empire, on which the sun never sets. The queen is dead, and this has given rise to conversations about the crimes of colonialism, as well as defenses and denials of it. To discuss empires both dead and dying, why colonialism still matters, and the anti-imperialist struggle around the world, I'm joined by Sina Rahmani, creator of East is a Podcast. But before we jump into it, be sure to hit the subscribe button and the bell so you get a notification whenever we post new content. And if you appreciate this show, you can help it grow by becoming a patron at patreon.com/breakthroughnews or by donating below on YouTube. Sina, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm such a big fan of your podcast, so I should open by saying everybody should go listen to East is a Podcast if you haven't already. And I guess, you know, a good place to start with this episode, since we have a kind of like a vast array of things we want to talk about related to imperialism, is the death of Queen Elizabeth. And I you know, you're in Canada, right? I should probably like give you my condolences or something, because she is also your queen.
According to the Lebanese state, she's actually more of your queen than she ever was our queen. 3 days of mourning.
I know. What is that? I was actually really surprised by that. I was like, really? I've never heard anybody say anything about the queen. But you know, it's interesting because I think like that's really, her death sparked a really interesting, though somewhat frustrating in many ways, conversation about the sort of legacy of British Empire. And on one side, it's like people are talking about colonialism, and it's not something that just happened like centuries ago. It's the entire 20th century. And you know, whether as like, you know, a direct empire in places like Kenya or Palestine, or, you know, got India, where the horrors are just, you know, we could do it. We would need more than just an episode to list the horrors that took place in India, not, you know, from famines and the partition and just the financial exploitation. I think the estimate is something like the UK drained $45 trillion of wealth from India. But like, just, you know, sitting here, I'm talking to you from Lebanon, just being in the Middle East. I mean, we had the establishment of all these horrible Gulf monarchies that were literally like funded by the British Empire. Had it not been for the British Empire, I don't think you'd have like a Saudi Arabia. And then talking about Iran, you know, like Saudi Arabia played a huge role in exploiting Iran and participating in the coup against the first democratically elected leader of Iran. I mean, I could go on and on and on. But I guess I'll let you go on and on and on. Like, what are your thoughts on the passing of the queen and what it means about what I think is like a dead empire, because now it's the U.S. that's in charge. But what does it mean about the dead empire and its relevance in the world today?
Yeah, no, first of all, I appreciate what you said about my show. I'm really touched that you're a fan, and I love your work, and I've been meaning to have you on since forever. So we're going to have to do this on my show soon.
You heard it here.
And so overall, like when we talk about the British Empire, is that there's no, like you could spend decades studying it, decades, like full time. And there are people who do this in different ways, albeit. And you couldn't even scratch the surface of its crimes, right? Because you can't just separate the British Empire from, say, its U.S. variant, right? Like its U.S., let's say, descendant. How about that? And even then, even if the U.S. empire, for instance, in its current form, is a product, it's settler colonial, obviously, it's a product of a European settler colonial project whose roots were sort of, let's say, sown by or whatever, like the seeds of which were sown by the British Empire, sure, like Britain, France, and Spain, they all rivaled for this continent in, you know, 17th, 18th centuries. And ultimately, like, it was the British power that eventually won out, with like the small exception of a place like Quebec. But even then, it was still a clear part of the British Empire. And even then, the French Empire was much smaller, and we can't even really compare them. But ultimately, when you kind of look at it in its global scope, just in its own sort of, let's say, 200 year apex, or like 200 year kind of trajectory, and it's older than that, especially if you ask the Irish, the Scottish, how they feel about that, it goes older. Then we're talking about the world's most violent political entity. So if we look at it in its global scope, this is centuries of genocidal violence, displacement, turning the world around, ecological devastation. It really boggles the mind what this entity called the British Empire manages to achieve too, and in the sense that it's not really dead. It's obviously handed over the rails. I like to like make the analogy between like an uncle and his like nephew, and that seems to be like the kind of like, that seems to be kind of like a good relationship, a kind of weird paternal, you know, somewhat, you know, they saw, what do they say, the special relationship, I think that's what it's called. But ultimately, like, the story of the British Empire and the US Empire and its like American descendant, you know, and the neo-colonial world that it erected, I mean, this is something that our species will have to reckon with for centuries from now on. Like, we will talk about the British Empire as one of the most like devastating forces in human history. I mean, and people can laugh at that all they want, but it's literally true, in the sense that it coincided with an era that this power that the British managed to achieve for upwards of, you know, 2-3 centuries at its apex. And it's different. Obviously, those histories are uneven. There's a story in, say, South Asia that there isn't, that's different from, say, the story of Turtle Island, right? So-called North America. And that's entirely different from the story in say, Southern Africa, right? Or Western Africa. Or Eastern Africa, actually, more correctly. So these are all, this is an interlocking, W.G. Zabold once described the Nazis as this like immense web of sorrow. And I think that that's, even if that's a correct assessment of what the National Socialists in Germany did, this is an even more immense web of sorrow. So that's all a big preface to saying that I have zero feelings for the death of this stupid, meaningless aristocrat to my life. I think that I'm, you know, like, if I never have to hear about the British royal family ever again, I'll be a happy person. Obviously, it's not going to happen. And I think the more interesting thing to talk about is that we actually don't think about the legacy of the British Empire. Instead, we think about the things that we're encouraged to think about, which is their, let's say, brand name figures, right? Like, the British aristocracy consists of thousands, tens of thousands of people, and who control a vast amount of the world wealth, and did control earlier, and, you know, centuries ago, or not even that long ago, a century ago, controlled a huge portion of the world's wealth, and had and enjoyed immense sway. I mean, this tiny little island, right, if you think about it, spread its power across the entire world. I mean, you and I are speaking English right now. I'm doing it from Canada, and you're doing it from Lebanon, and we have this, like, interlocking, we have this, like, strange thing, and that's, like, in a sense, the British Empire, it infected our genetics, like the genetics, yeah, of our history. Like, we won't be able to really understand it. We certainly won't, living in this era, but centuries from now, they'll look back and, like, it'll be this, you know, this never ending panorama of sorrow and pain and destruction and violence and ecological destruction, of immense wealth hoarding, theft. These things should be what we talk about when we talk about Britain, but we don't. We talk about tea and crumpets. We talk about the stiff upper lip. We talk about Dickens. I mean, I'm guilty of this too. Like, I'm a practitioner of British literature. I have a PhD in 19th century British literature. I mean, who's got the problem? You know, like me right here. Like this is, you're looking at it, folks. Like the force of this cultural hegemony, of this hegemonic power of the British Empire will take a long, long time to come to terms with. And the fact that we're subjected to this absurd media circus around this completely, you know, personality-less, lack of charisma aristocrat who just sat there, and we were subjected to all of their stupid domestic problems. Meanwhile, like one of them is raping children, and probably more than one. And of course, that is the legacy of the British Empire, is child rape. And that's exactly what they are. And so I propose we don't even call it, England anymore in this conversation. We just refer to it as Pedo Island from now on, which is the kind of treatment that we should, that's the kind of approach we should take with all things to do with British and Empire. And, you know, and that's my own view, but that's a deeper thing of my own kind of rejection of my PhD and my education, I guess.
No, I actually didn't. I didn't know you had a PhD in 19th century British literature. That's really fascinating. I mean, you're actually more qualified to talk about this than anybody else at the moment. But no, I mean, that's a really good point about Prince Andrew, who the British royal or Queen Elizabeth herself like paid for his legal fees because he was sued by Virginia Guthrie, who was one of Jeffrey Epstein's victims, spent a lot of time on Jeffrey Epstein's, I can't even say what it's called because this is a family program. But anyways, I think Pedo Island's really good. And I think one thing that's so important to emphasize, especially as we're like forced to see all of these liberals in the West demonstrate how much they actually love monarchy, which is not something I thought I'd see, and talk about like what a legacy Queen Elizabeth and her empire had, and see people like Tucker Carlson deny like genocidal colonialism, literally, is the fact that the UK, England, Pedo Island, whatever you want to call it, would not be wealthy. Neither would Europe had it not been for the fact that they erected this empire to steal, to literally loot wealth from the parts of the world where you can actually grow food and where there actually is oil. Everybody talks about the, you know, England's industrial revolution, how important it was. It was literally it happened because of what they took from India and Africa and I think I saw a map, like there's no corner of the world except for, I think, like Antarctica that the British Empire did not invade or colonize in some way. So you're absolutely right. And I think it's interesting too, because one of the reasons why I think it's so difficult for the mainstream to talk about the crimes of the British Empire is because while the UK is no longer an empire, you mentioned uncle and nephew. I mean, the US really took over the mantle of leader of the empire in a much different way, of course, than the British did. I mean, you don't have old school colonialism like you used to, but you have this kind of like imperialism carried out with, you know, because of the dominance of the dollar through the use of the US military. So I'm just curious, you know, as we sort of are stepping into this era of new Cold Wars with the rise of China, moving on from the death of the British Empire to the U.S. Empire, do you see the U.S. Empire as a dying empire? And of course, like, I don't say that in a naive way. Like, even if the U.S. is weakened, I understand it's still very, very powerful and still the most powerful country in the world. However, it does seem to be at the beginning of some sort of decline. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the decline is an interesting term. I mean, there's different things. We're talking about as a hegemonic entity on the global stage. That's one thing called the United States, and that's the empire. The country itself, namely the settler colonials, basically continent, which stretches a continent, right? Like the U.S.'s own, its own sort of fictionality is kind of obvious in the difference, say, between like Maine and, you know, Southern California, right? Or Florida and Washington State, right? We're supposed to, and then that's not even considering their off-seas colonial, their colonies. And I do have to say is that, you know, the idea that, you know, you said about, you know, old school colonialism doesn't really happen now. The thing is that what we think of as old school colonialism isn't really old school colonialism, it's just colonialism, is that there is the advent of something called neocolonialism, and it did evolve, but say the colonial, like the naked colonial grab of the U.S., say, the last 20 years, and prior to that too, but say just in Iraq, Afghanistan, and then it's through its proxies in Yemen and Syria and Libya, you know, and not even through its proxies, it was NATO, which I guess is a proxy of the US. But these are all sort of like interlocking, these are all kind of overlapping terms to describe like a world empire, like a world, like a force on the global stage whose ability to deter its rivals, and rivals is the wrong term, because to call China and say Russia rivals of the US is wrong, because rivals suggest they're all part of the same race. Now, people love to say, oh, China's colonialist. Yes, like China is a great power. Russia is a great power. But what we talk about is imperialism, like capital I imperialism, is that mantle has been inherited by the US, and the UK still participates in it. It's an integral part of the US empire of imperial force, both in terms of as a military force, right? Like, and as a financial hub, right? And as a strange kind of like a political kind of tag team duo, whereby and a continuation and it's you know, force, and it's sort of a continuation of an older game of domination. And we talked about the Gulf, mentioned the Gulf earlier. It's totally true that the Gulf wouldn't exist as its form, as a current form, if it wasn't wholly invented, if these monarchies weren't wholly invented by the British and to a lesser degree by the Americans, and erected and put into power, and their power is secured by not just American weapons, but also American troops since the 1990s, right? Since the 1990s and the first Gulf War, first invasion of Iraq, which is to say, that put presence of U.S. troops on that kind of soil. And there were other ones, but ultimately this is an evolution. And you have to think about these things as these kind of, it's hard to even look at as a whole, the British Empire. Like, how do you even wrap your head around it? Like, from the experiences in Ireland of the 19th century, of the mid-19th century, right? And what they call the Great Hunger, stretching from the dozens, possibly hundreds of famines artificially induced in South Asia and India to, you know, everywhere else. I mean, the clear cutting of the forests of Turtle Island, right? I mean, this is ecological genocide, not to mention the actual human genocide that coincided and continues, right, in the form of settler colonial politics whose antecedents lie directly in the country of that queen who just died. Right? That's what she symbolizes. And the fact that once again, everything gets sucked up into this never-ending culture war. So instead of talking about the legacy of the British Empire and even just scratching the surface of it, which is an exhausting, painful, very like rage-inducing, you know, thing, we're sitting here debating the merits of people's responses to her death, right? Yeah. That's what we're doing, okay? That's the reality. That's how low our discourses. That's how paltry what masquerades as kind of news culture is. Like all these blue check marks with their seriousness, it just comes down to talking about people's reaction to the news. Like, yeah, they're no different than any sort of sports commentator. I mean, sometimes sports commentators actually do a better job in terms of just looking at something occurring and animating it with some kind of like verbal discourse. And that seems to be the job of the news. And then now the emergence of online culture and a kind of participatory response culture into the news, which is different than when we were kids, right? When we were kids, the news was one way. Now we not just like participate in the news, but you're actively making it online in the sense that all local news has just turned into, this is what happened on the internet yesterday. That's kind of a strange evolution. So an event like the death of a British monarch and like allows for a great flattening of everything. So everybody has to be talking about that. Everybody has to engage that. And that's the kind of information world that the American Empire has given us, right?
Yeah.
That kind of never-ending, globe-spanning cultural jihad that is at every level of the US media discourse, from, you know, like 14-year-old like vlogger on YouTube screaming, right, to like Tucker Carlson. I mean, it's basically the same thing, but with a much larger audience. Like that is just one. And like CNN, right? Like I say this a lot. CNN is the world's most expensive, most elaborate, most well-produced podcast. It's just four people sitting around a desk talking. Like that's our media culture. And so instead of talking about like actual hard things that take, you know, that take a kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like you have to sit and deliberate the decline of the US empire and what that means, right? You have to sit and say like, okay, do you mean the country or do you mean its hegemonic force? And if it's hegemonic force, that means this. And its country, it means this. And if you want to talk about the country, then you have to look at the little local paces. So let's look at California. Let's look at Florida. Let's look at Texas. Look at the situation. I mean, that's the hard thing. And that takes time and that takes expertise and that takes limitless amounts of talking, but even more listening and being like, wow, I didn't know that's the economy of like West Virginia. Like, oh, I didn't know that it's controlled, that this state's wealth is controlled by like four families. I mean, like this is even true about like even in country like Canada too, like New Brunswick. I just learned this the other day. It's like owned by like one family. Like, really? Like one huge oligarch, like some degree, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I misheard this. But essentially, like there are these oligarchies and things happening in our world that we have no clue. And our media culture is there to ensure that only a tiny fraction of it, I mean, not to be a pseudo-intellectual like philosophy nerd, but it really is like we're stuck in the cave still. We're stuck in Plato's cave. And the shadow puppets are like these ghoulish imperial clowns who own these like handful of media companies. And we're all just like forced to sit there and sit and like sell with the kind of self-seriousness, sit there and be like, wow, this is really interesting fragments of images that are going by me 1 million miles per hour. So it's hard, you know, like to put it, it's just hard. You can't, there's no easy way. It takes hours and hours of unraveling and an ocean of experts who have like local knowledge and then languages that are hard to interact. Like, there are so many things in terms of like fighting imperialist war, like info war. And, you know, it's just us doing it. It's a bunch of amateurs from their houses doing it. Like, that's it.
What are you saying? I know what you're saying. No, I think it's a really good, that's an excellent point. And I'm actually, because you're in Canada, I am curious. I assume the conversation in Canada is very much like it is in the US about the Queen and stuff. I know that in Beirut, the Canadian flag at the embassy is at half mast to honor to the dead queen. But you know, to pivot from the issue, I think Canada like is viewed by most Americans, having grown up in the US, I can say this as an expert. Canada is viewed as being like this really harmless neighbor next door full of like overly nice people almost to an irritating degree, rather than what it actually is, which is an appendage of the US, I think, empire. That also has a really, even though we don't see Canada as a right-wing country, a very right-wing foreign policy, especially with regard to Ukraine. There's a fairly large Ukrainian diaspora community. And Canada, many of whom are like the children of Nazis, like is it foreign minister?
Foreign minister? Yeah.
Yeah, Chrystia Friedland. But, you know, I'm just curious if you can like, maybe do you have anything to add about that? Because I do think that Canada's role in the war in Ukraine is quite interesting. They've been sending a lot of weapons. I think there's even less debate in Canada about NATO and the proxy war in Ukraine than there is even in the U.S., which is pretty shocking. So I'm curious if you can maybe, I know it's kind of a big pivot, but if you can, first of all, explain that Canada isn't some nice, lovely place that's harmless, but also its role in this NATO proxy war in Ukraine, because we don't really think about it much in regard to that.
No, I think, and it's actually not that much of a pity if you think about it, because we're sitting here talking about the legacy of the British Empire. And the difference between Canada and the U.S. is proof positive of that the relationships and the sort of evolution of these different yet overlapping settler colonial projects that are around the world, right? South Africa, like important nodes of which lie in sort of South Africa, Australia, Canada, the U.S. And like that, like New Zealand, whatever, like that project resulted in a complicated family of countries whose own evolution differed, for different reasons, right? So, which is not that radical of a thought. It's like, ooh, countries, different countries have different histories. My God, breaking news, Sini. But in the sense that they all came from the same historical British settler colonial route. Now, Canada's a bit more complicated. We have two of them rivaling each other. And there were rivals in the U.S., like the French were in the U.S. They were trying rivaling. It didn't last as long, and it wasn't as elaborate. And its legacy, the legacy of, say, the French imperial settler colonial project didn't last as long in the U.S. as it, say, did in Canada, right, where there's a whole very large province of who are speaking French, who are live their lives in, you know, this entirely, like, it is a minority language in Canada. However, it's a very large minority. Millions of people speak French, and they have their own kind of, what was the term in the 90s? Distinct culture, distinct society? I can't remember, actually. And I mean, however you want to call it. And there was actually, they had this whole like sovereignty push, which is an interesting, if not kind of warped, you know, weird kind of ethno-nationalism that sort of takes the tools of decolonization, right? The language and the kind of ideas of decolonization, but really in the name of a separate settler colonial society, which is, we are a French settler colonial society, different from the English Canadian settler colonial society. Now, that's Canada's origins, right? But its origins are also in the sense that they share that settler colonial project in the sense that, like, they're a genocidal entity who erased millions of people and these civilizations, these thousands of year old civilizations that existed here that thrive, right? And that's forcible displacement and encirclement. And then they're essentially like, you know, like these treaties that were signed to end these wars, because these indigenous people did put up significant and very real and very costly struggles against these wars. And part of the world, part of the countries, the settler colonial countries that exist today, is that these hard-won pockets, come sometimes called called reservations, or depending on how you want to call it, but these pockets of, to some degree, different degree, sovereign control, right? And these are things that, say, Europeans don't really understand, right? That, like, in terms of when you think of like a country like Germany, right, its nationality, it's like its condition of being a nation state, whatever you want to call it, is wholly different than the American, Australian, you know, Canadian, whatever variety. Now, to get to continue the answer, that now the relationship between Canada and the U.S. is one of global hegemon and, right, as you put it, appendage. We are the appendage of the U.S. We are a, I mean, there is something to be said about Jean Chrétien's resistance on Iraq. He participated in a lot of other U.S. imperial projects, but resisted that one for the liberals of that time, resisted for their own reasons. Now, their legacy, the liberals of today, gladly participate in a lot of different regime change projects, like Canada has on the whole. There are differences of opinions between the U.S. and Canada on foreign policy occasionally, but ultimately, we are their resource hub, and we are essentially one of their like precious sort of, they're called the Five Eyes country, that they share this kind of unique relationship with the U.S. in terms of its global surveillance project, which means its global hegemony, right? We're part of the game, right? Like, if British Empire and if the rivalry, if the kind of the term that was from the 19th century, the great game, you know, if that was supposed to be the rivalry between England and Russia or a general, I guess that was kind of one of the stories. But, you know, the idea of this great game, the U.S. is the main player, and we're part of the supporting cast, right? We're like cheering them on from the bench. They've put us in for a couple of minutes in like the fourth quarter on stuff if they need us, to like use a sports analogy. But like ultimately, like that's what Canada does. And Canada's like, you know, and now to answer the other question in terms of its perception among Americans, now what you're talking about is in terms of what is a citizen's relationship to its state that oversees, that ultimately controls its life or is responsible for its life, right? Like a state is a body of violence. It's like this legal entity, but it's obviously like what that means is that it can do violence to you, and it can deprive you of your freedoms if you don't follow its rules. It depends, obviously, if you're a member of a certain class, you can depend much different than other classes. Obviously, that rule is uneven, but nevertheless, like that's the relationship between a subject and whatever you want to say, like a sovereign or whatever. If that sovereign takes this legal entity, it's like the form of like this legal entity, which most states do now. Now, that relationship is different in the US than it is in Canada. That's clearly Canada is this largely social democratic. It has its neoliberal characteristics, but it is a very rich country, not unlike the sort of Nordic states with a large sort of natural resource base as its economy, which then can provide a relatively comfortable quality of life for its citizens. Once again, with important notes of it, because it's still ultimately a capitalist society, and it's a class society, and it's a racist capitalist society. So that, say, there are plenty of indigenous communities who don't have fresh and something simple as drinking water, right? Like that is a form of, you know, that's a combination of things. That's a combination of a long war, a continuation of a long war of genocide, sure. But it's also a register. It's also like something about how the class character and how cities and places closest to urban metropoles get more sort of civic attention than, say, rural populations, especially if they're, say, indigenous. Now, that's a simplification, sure. But ultimately, that's a big difference. And these countries evolve differently from the same sort of genetics. I hate these biopolitical metaphors, but they work in this case. Like the same kind of, like, you know, the same kind of race war project. And it was a kind of race war, even if they had a kind of internal strife in Canada between the French and the English variety, that they shared ultimately a kind of anti-indigenousness and anti-blackness, I mean, to a different degree. And even less, to a lesser degree, anti-Catholicism, because that's also part of the story here too. But that's a kind of general, that's a kind of broad strokes answer to your question. I will admit, I barely pay attention to Canadian national politics, and I pay even less attention to its foreign policy, again, because it's so immaterial. Now, is that my failure as like a citizen? Probably, like, because my taxes, like, how funded, right? You? Like, I pay taxes. Like, my, yeah, like, I mean, the same way, like, you know, like the kleptocracy, like the Lebanese kleptocratic state, like you participated in too. Now, those two things are not the same, mind you. Like, that's not the same participation. Now, I'm a contributory force to you, like sort of the vassal role that Canada plays in the U.S. imperial, sure. And I should pay attention more. Like, I should talk more about, like, our, you know, insane clown princess foreign minister and her, like, Nazi grandfather that we all know about. And like that's what they are. Like, that's, and then, you know, our blackface loving, black and brown face loving prime minister, you know, like, these are all very sinister things that betray a class character and, like, the origins of Canada as being part of this, like, racist settler colonial empire that loves to do blackface, that loves to do brownface. That's like when Justin Trudeau was caught doing those pictures, if you can splice them in here, they're just too good not to share. But like when he was caught, he was participating in a British imperial practice. Yeah. Right? Like, that's a treasured British imperial social practice of donning this black and brown makeup and, like, making fun of natives. It just, someone took a picture of it stupidly and, like, that, like, and then let it go. And he was dumb enough to, like, never think that this could get out one day. But that's what this class does. That's what this class is. That, like, his people have been doing this for centuries. They've been putting, like, shoe polish on their face while they were drunk at dinner parties and, like, saying that stuff and, like, saying all kinds of things, because that's the culture ultimately of white supremacy. And that's where he comes from. So, like, these moments of, like, where you get to see into their own kind of cultural genetics are interesting. But the branding campaigns of, like, oh, Canada is a fun place where you can go and, you know, do snowboarding and buy weed on every corner. Yes, those are true. You can buy weed on every corner and you can snowboard, right? But that's you talking about as a consumer, right? Yeah. That's not, like, the character of the state. And, like, that character is very, very ugly.
You know, I to flip it around too, like, what I think is interesting that's taking place right now when you talk about the character of these states is, it's really disgusting on all fronts. Like, obviously there's a big PR apparatus, mostly through Hollywood, that builds these kinds of images of these various settler colonial entities that really does, I think, impact the way people in the third world do view the United States or Canada or Australia or the UK. But on the flip side of that, I think that something interesting happens, because when we talk about appendages of the US, if we're going to refer to Canada that way and like the other Five Eyes countries, I think a lot of times the imperial powers, the colonial powers, whatever you want to call them, have this tendency to project that dynamic onto resistance in the global South. And I'll give an example of what I mean by that. Like, when you look at the Middle East, just to take one part of the world, where I think right now there is probably one of the strongest moments of like resistance capability that the Middle East has ever really had in terms of its ability to challenge US hegemony in the region, like actually militarily. And that's a lot of that, all of that actually is because of Iran. Iran is like at the center of what we call the resistance axis, right? That said, you have Hezbollah, which is its own thing in Lebanon, has Lebanese interests. You have the Palestinian groups in Gaza, in the West Bank, wherever, have their own interests. You have the Syrians, you have the Iraqis. And I mean, I would say that all of these various groups that are part of the resistance axis have actually their own agency and their own interests and aren't controlled by or appendages of Iran. But the way they're discussed in Western discourse is that they're proxies. And I just think that that's such a huge irony, because like you can look at, you know, Ukraine, I think, as a, in many ways, a proxy of the West, but I don't think you can look at Hezbollah as a proxy of Iran. Anyways, I'm curious your thoughts on basically all those things I just mentioned, particularly the idea that right now in the Middle East, there really is an interesting level of resistance capability that never existed before, and that even has proven itself able to act as a deterrence to various forms of U.S. imperialism in the region, whether they're talking about the Israelis and basically, you know, them not being able to invade Lebanon since 2006 because of Hezbollah's existence, or whether we're talking about the Iraqis and the Syrians and their ability to push back against the attempts by the U.S. and all of its proxies to like impose an Al-Qaeda style state in Syria. And we can go on and on, but I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, this actually goes back to your first question. I think it was the first question about the dying U.S. empire. And it's like that death has been, and it's a kind of, it's a dying, and it's a death of a certain form of British empire as well. Because ultimately, like as we said earlier, it's that the torch was passed from uncle to nephew like a while back, probably like over a century ago, really. And that project is now firmly in American hands. Now, that project requires the ability to flex on your enemies, and to use the colloquialism, but really like the political science term is to like tell your enemies that like if you don't do as we tell you, if you don't take your position in the world economic order, if you don't take your position into like the global supply chain, right, then we're gonna mess your country up. It will be, and there are different ways we can do that. The toolkit that the US that in, you know, has itself, which was inherited in some ways in the Brits, but also developed together, right? Like this is a global imperial mission, and the like MI5 or whatever, like the UK intelligence, imperial intelligence apparatus, you know, emerged or like helped birth the CIA, like OSS or whatever. And that is because that's part of the handoff. That's part of the relay race of this imperial system, is to all conglomerate your forces and use them. And I think to take it back to the question of like the Middle East and West Asia, whatever you want to call it, that is that the remnants of that is that these small countries, like Lebanon's what, 4 million, something like
six
that?
Million.
Like what's the population? 6 million. Sorry. Six million.
Don't,
a six
don't
million
try to make us less than we are.
It's just cool. It's one. It's the GTA. It's Toronto. It's like it's. I mean, Canada's 40 million, which is less than California. So whatever. I mean, whatever population size. Lebanon is strong. I refuse to make any jokes right now about the fictionality of Lebanon. I will never hear the end.
You
of
are
it
no on this I program. No, not for me. But I can't promise you, some Phoenician is not going to hear this and be offended.
I mean, this is related, right? Like the modern countries, the carving up of the modern, so-called modern Middle East, it was intended to create relatively small, disconjoined states who then were vulnerable to different things, right? Like Lebanon does not have a huge ton of resources. It has geography, sure, it has its location at the intersection of, like, you know, obviously the Mediterranean, but also it's over land, right? Between a kind of bridge and the Levant to other places. Like, that's an important role in its economy. But the fact that it's had, first of all, like, not just carved up with, like, violent and occupied by the French, right? And then later on, it's political, like, in the era, the so-called formal era of European decolonization, right? It was when it was handed off to a bunch of neo-colonial elites, right? But ultimately, with the sword hanging over its head of, like, okay, if you fall out of line, we have these different tools, right? That we can make things happen. And this is something that happens the world over, right? This is true for Chile. This is true for, you know, like, all kinds of countries. Different parts of Africa have this reality whereby if they don't, you know, gladly participate in whatever raw material extraction that the world order needs from them, the global north needs from them, then that's going to cause problems, right? Case in point, Evo Morales, right? Like, right. God forbid these people take control of their own resources, right? This is, and so I think the story of the dwindling power of the US empire is very much locked up in this small, albeit kind of, we can call it an NGO, which is funny, but Hezbollah is an NGO, right? It is a non-governmental organization with a military wing, which began as a paramilitary guerrilla fighter force, which grew into a large non-governmental organization that has huge power, that has its own, that represents a large voting bloc of Lebanese society. Now, there are lots of Lebanese people who are throwing eggs at me right now in their hearts and saying to me, like, oh my God, that's not, how can you call them a non-governing entity? They literally are in the government. But that's the thing. If the ideals of liberal democracy were supposed to take root in the Middle East, if this was supposed to be the story, Lebanon, like, Hezbollah's rise should be considered a success story, right? You're talking about a group of farmers who picked up AK-47s to fight a colonial occupation by Zionist troops, right? They fought them, and it now evolved into a nationwide, like, political movement whose leader has the ability to mobilize hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people, right? That's not some rabbit out of the hat trick that any old buddy, like, can do. Very few people on this planet can you describe with that kind of power in his hands. Now, does Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, does he literally sit there and point and say, everybody change that light bulb, right? Like, no, he doesn't do that. But that's not how political systems work. That's not how political movements work, right? They evolve over time. They have members, they have organizations, they have media, they have economic relationships with people who aren't in their group. They have agriculture, right? Like, this is all a huge organization. And yet in the West, they're called a terrorist group. Now, of course, we know why they're called a terrorist group, because they do exactly this. They demanded and have achieved sovereign control over at least parts of Lebanon, right? Sovereignty doesn't mean they rule over it, but it means that they've established sovereignty, because the sovereignty of Lebanon, which is to say that were the Israelis to invade tomorrow, which is something they've done before gladly many times over, right? If they did that, the deterrent power of Hezbollah developed, even which has grown exponentially since 2006, which was a debacle for the Zionists and for the Americans and the Brits, right? Because this is all kind of, they're all part of the same team, right? The fact that power has grown, that they've established a deterrent that says, oh, you want to invade us? Say goodbye to Haifa. Say goodbye to your power plants, right? Like, say goodbye. Like, you're going to live the way you made us live many times, right? So now this deterrence equation has changed. And that's the true sort of, like, inflection point of our moment that you and I get to live through. And we've seen change. Like, we watched in '90s, we watched the U.S. empire just stomp its boot anywhere it wanted to go, right? Mm-hmm. But there's something else behind that. If, say, by the 90s, say the U.S. went crazy and said, we want to invade Iran, Iran at that point had already established deterrence. Same thing for the DPRK. Same thing for China. Same thing with Russia. Russia always had kind of deterrence. I guess you could say that they had nukes and stuff, and they had a kind of deterrent power. Now, that's what you need to fight against an empire. That's what people have. Now, again, all you rubes out there who are screaming and saying Russia and China are an empire, no, they are great powers. They are great powers. And yes, great powers can abuse great power and impose, say, unjust and unsanctioned and illegal things. Yes. Does that constitute imperialism? No. That does not constitute imperialism. The imperialist powers are a bloc. That's why they all joined together. That's why Turkey joined them. That's why Japan joined them, right? That's why former empires joined the US and the Europeans. That's why the Europeans joined the US, because it's an interlocking system. It's a relay. It's like, you know, I don't know if your editor will watch wrestling. I don't know if you watched wrestling. I don't know. A lot of people didn't. But this is like, it's like a Survivor series of like, there's like one guy who's at the head of it, and there's like three of them arrayed behind it. Like that's the imperialism of our world order. It's like, there's like the US, which is leads it. And then there's like the British guy who has his own stereotype. There's the Japanese guy in the corner. There's like the Turkish guy, the mad whatever sheikh, or like the, let's call him like a dervish or something. Like that's like what imperialism looks like today. And those countries target other great powers at times.
Yeah.
And they have relationships with other great powers. Yes. Right. America and its imperial force has a relationship with, say, Russia that it doesn't say with China. Right.
Yeah.
Does it fund? Does it orchestrate a colossal 10-year-long proxy war against China through its neighbor? No. Right. It doesn't do that because it couldn't work. Right. Mm-hmm. But did it do that in the case of Russia? It did work. And now we're living in like the seeds of that proxy war. Right. Like this proxy war in Ukraine was intended to eventually grow into a conflict like this, an open hot war, which it has been for 8 years now, with like immense death. Right. I mean, nothing approaching the kinds of death we've seen in 20 years in, say, West Asia. Sure. But we're not in like an Olympics of pain here. But in the sense that like these wars that have multiplied since that 2000s, right, that have been led primarily by the imperialist bloc, which is led primarily by the U.S., these have been responsible for immense pain and suffering. Hundreds of millions of people displaced from Central Asia to the Caucasus to the kinds, even you can even include the neoliberal economic policies instituted on Mexican people and like their agricultural class, which led directly to the the proletarianization of a huge number of them, which then fed into a cheap labor and lowered the cost of labor in the US, right? Like these is all like an immense like symphony of hegemonic power that the US conducts. And like there are different portions of it and there are different players, but like that's what we live in. And there are countries that are outside of it, and those countries have increasingly drawn lines that the US, without serious consequences, destructive consequences that make it not worth it, can't cross. And that's the moment we're now living in. And the question becomes, what do the monstrous, parasitic, you know, sociopathic, like ghouls who administer the US and British Empire, like what do they do to this dying world? Like, what do they do with this dying world power? They see that their ship is sinking, or at least the ship of its power and its ability to like stomp on anything it wants, it's sinking. So what do they do? I can't help but think that they're going to make it as worse. They're going to say, if we go to hell, I'm taking you with me.
Yeah, take the world
with
us.
I feel like that's where, and they'd prefer that. They'd prefer that we all live with them in their horrible world. I mean, that's the Communist Manifesto, right? Like they make the world in their own image. And so they want the world to be this nuclear, like this like irradiated nuclear wasteland, or they get to control it and it gets to be nice for them and their select friends, right? Like that's it. That's the two options of the imperialists. And it's terrible. And we live through this time.
No, it's horrible. And you know, it's interesting too, because like they're also bringing themselves, and that's what sanctions are all about. Cause like the way they're sanctioning everything, it's kind of like, well, you think you're going to take us down? We're taking you all down with us, because we're just going to sanction all the countries in the world that are where all the raw commodities come from. Like, let's sanction the biggest gas producers and biggest oil producers and cause huge recessions around the world and shortages of fertilizer and wheat. I mean, the damage they're doing with just the sanctions on Russia alone to the global South are insane. And they're willing to do it because it's worth, you know, a bunch of people in Africa starving to death for the US to maybe weaken Russia. And if it doesn't, well, then you're going down with us. That's actually like an important aspect of the mentality But, you know, there's somebody else who died recently who did not get the same attention as the Queen, though he was, like, you know, given nice obituaries in the U.S., and that's Gorbachev, who passed away. But I think he got a different kind of reaction from the West than he did probably in Russia, given that Gorbachev, you know, he oversaw the death of the Soviet Union, or the, you know, decline of the Soviet Union and the breaking up of it, and as really seen as, like, single-handedly destroying it, and which led to, like, millions of deaths from poverty and disease and alcoholism and ethnic conflict that came with the sort of neoliberalization that was imposed on Russia and the former Soviet state. So I'm just curious, what's your response to the death of Gorbachev?
Well, again, I mean, I think this is part and parcel of, like, the media environment that we live in, is that then this hyper fixation on individuals and their ability to supposedly, like, pull the levels of power in their own country, right? Like, the media atmosphere that we grew up with is hyper fixated on presidential power, for instance, right? Like, yeah. The news is the news about the president. And it's been that way since for decades now, at least, right? And, like, that's the kind of American imagination of the news. And that's kind of one model of it. And so a part of the fascination with Gorbachev, I think, is that, first of all, that he was an ally and, like, and somebody who assisted the West in their goals, which was the dismantlement of the Soviet Union. Now, it's important to remember, the U.S. regime changed the remnants, remnants of the Soviet Union. What was left, there was, like, this core of power, and they did a regime change operation to get Boris Yeltsin into power. So even though they were playing by the rules, this new order, like, say, for instance, like, the head of the KGB, he gave the CIA a map of all of their surveillance, I think, like, the ways they had bugged the U.S. embassy. They gave them, like, a map of that. Like, Russia allowed, like, monitors, American monitors. Like, it was a complete, let's say, capitulation. I mean, I think it's the wrong word, but in the sense that if these were Cold War antagonists, if they were antagonists, this was what the late 80s and the early 90s, mid-90s, until the mid-90s, represented the complete and utter capitulation of this new country called Russia, right? And the triumphalism of the Americans over this guy, over the Soviet Union, right? Over, like, the victory over the Soviet Union, is still something that liberals, and especially its liberals, they parrot this and they love it. Whereas in reality, there was a lot of violence, right? As you said, a lot of their social indicators, a lot of, like, their basic life quality things just plummeted. They lost millions of people to emigration, right? This country depopulated, they de-developed it, which is what they do to third world countries that are their enemy, right? They first conquer them, and then they de-develop them, which is, like, true neoliberal style, in the hopes of attaining as much raw material as possible, right? Now, Russia is the land of raw material to these people, to the ghouls, right? Mm-hmm. And for a good 10 years, there was a feeding frenzy. Now, what happened? Somebody from their own deep state, right? His name is Vladimir Putin. Like,
no,
came out of their system. He came out of their system and said, and, like, asserted a kind of political power that had been in a vacuum for almost 10 years, right? Like, Boris Yeltsin had legitimate, deep, like, diseased, alcoholic mind who was not capable of doing his job. And yet this guy was making huge decisions, or at least supposedly looking like it. And one of the decisions he made, again, strange way in history is works in strange ways. One of the decisions he made was to hand over the reins of power to this guy from the deep state, who had hitherto not really been known. He had been working in, I think, St. Petersburg for a mayor. I think that was his trajectory. And before that, he was famously in the KGB. He was trained as a lawyer, right? Like, Vladimir Putin's rise to the presidency and his own stay in power, which has been, you know, which has been through phases, legal phases that have evolved, right? I mean, the fact that this guy has, what, 70% like approval rating, 65% of approval rating, that is something that no leader in the West can even approach, right? Mm-hmm. I think the most Obama ever had was like 60 or something, maybe 50. I don't even remember now. Like no approach. So if like liberals who bash their heads over like the evil of Putin, what you're saying is 70% of Russians are supporting evil, right? Like you're willing to say that. Like if you really think the bad things about Russia and Vladimir Putin, then 70% or 65% of Russians think those bad things. And that's what you think of Russians, right? Like that's what you think. That's what you think they do. Like you're so, like we speak with such confidence about other places in the world. And yet at the same time, we ban their media. We deny them. I love this quote. It's from Edward Said. We deny them the permission to narrate, right? Mm. All their channels get blocked. Our freedom-loving liberal media establishment enjoys nothing other than pressing the block button, which doesn't mean like block them from seeing your feed. It means block them from being seen by anybody else, right? Like the principles of liberal enlightenment go out the window. The mm-hmm. moment, like the moment a liberal is challenged by anyone, right? Those go out the window. We know that from history, right? Like the liberal enlightenment supposedly birthed in the 18th century. This is also when they colonized a huge chunk of the world. It was the same people. It was the same Scotsmen and Irishmen and Brits, these same people who were writing nice things. Their contemporaries raped and pillaged and stole and burned villages and mutilated people and took their body parts and collected their everything. And that's the political, the remnants, the ashes of that imperial looting of the world. And then when you combine, that wasn't even the only European empire. When you combine that into this horrible monstrosity with the Spanish, with the French, with the Portuguese, with the German, with the Austrian, with the Turks. I'll include the Turks because you want to be included in Europe so badly. We'll include you here. Okay, with the Austro-Hungarians. Like this is a continent, this continent of Europe, which doesn't exist, right? Which is fake, right? It's Eurasia, actually, if it's an idea of a landmass. But this entity in our minds of imagined geography, like is responsible for billions of deaths. This is the source of immense, immense human violence, right? And until we start to dismantle their lies, which means when the aging 90-year-old monarch of one of the countries dies, we laugh at them and mock them, and we spend, you know, the next month circulating images, and we should be doing that every day, right? Like we have to do the painful work of bearing witness to the violence of empire. And instead of getting and that's kind of what the goal of a lot of anti-imperialist media work is, right? Like looking at the chaos, like looking at, you know, like like Benjamin's angel of history, right? Like there's the, like you're staring at this rubble pile up, and it gets bigger and bigger, and occasionally a gust of wind will like push you forward, right? And like that's the only job you have as like somebody like doing media today. That's the only job you should have, is to do your best to like bear witness to the like insane political violence that our elites, like literally our elites, like the people who run our countries, right? And you, not so much, but me, like,
thank you.
Like that's,
well,
like, that's,
fair, I am American. Like, I am American as well.
Yeah, I mean, so, yeah, you're part of it too.
That.
You're just,
you can get me on that. I want to be a part of them. Like, I want to be a part of the mean people. No, I'm just joking. I definitely don't.
I mean, we are. Well, they conscripted us. We had no choice.
We were born into it. I mean, I don't know about your situation, but like my family went to the United States because there was a war in Lebanon that you could.
Yeah,
tie
me too. War in Iraq. Right? They bring war everywhere they go. They've waged, like, people don't realize this. They don't even realize the last 20 years of wars. People don't stitch together Syria, Yemen, Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan. They don't stitch them together because our media class does this important work of bracketing everything off. Right? This is the news segment on Afghanistan. This is the news segment on Iraq, right? They have these ways that, oh, this is the civil war in Syria. Oh, this is the civil war in Yemen, right? Like they have this ability to manufacture the world as these series of isolated conflicts. Whereas in reality, we're talking about just in the last 20 years alone, 25 or 20, whatever, 22. Like you're talking about five, six major world conflicts. And that's not including Ukraine. We should include Ukraine also. Like six major wars that bring in over probably a billion people, like that's probably one of the profound like markers. Like, we'll be living in the remnants of this violence that's just in West Asia alone for another century. Like, Syria will be rebuilding for another 50-70 years to attain. Now, that might be wrong. Maybe it'll be faster. Maybe it'll be 20 years. Maybe it'll be 25. I don't know. There's a new world coming. I believe that much.
Well, I hope there is, because as I love that, as you were like on that whole rant about my electricity just shut off because I'm in Lebanon, which is a part of everything you just said, but please continue. I just wanted to anybody who why did Rakia just
They want people living in misery. They want people living in misery. They want people de-developed, especially those countries that don't fall in line, that don't heal, right? So Lebanon is one of them. Syria is another one. They want Iran to do it. They try to starve it, but Iran is rich in its own natural resources, which is to say it has energy, and so they can, and it has land, so it could produce its own food, and it could heat itself, and it can light its own, it can electrify itself, which is huge, right? To any modern nation state. Syria used to be able to. Unfortunately, their oil fields are occupied by the US and they're being looted, right? And meanwhile, the liberal our media class here, even left liberal, just doesn't say a word, right? Like, we have more war now than we did during the Iraq and Afghanistan era. There's more wars because they're still in Afghanistan. They're still in Iraq, right? Like, they're still occupying. Sure, their forces have been greatly reduced, but the imperial project is just as much active as it was before 20 years ago. It's just evolved into a different phase, right? And people support it now, and they argue with you if you dare to dare to question it. I mean, that's, we've gone backwards. We've gone backwards.
You're an Assadist, you're a Putin stooge, you're a genocide denialist, you love authoritarianism. We've all dealt with this stuff. It's getting old at this point. I don't know if it has the same effect that it had maybe 5 or 6 years ago, or maybe it goes up and down in waves. But, you know, I think that's a good point to almost wrap on, because I do want to ask you with regard to your podcast, because we do something very similar, which is what you talked about, which is anti-imperialist media work. And so I'm curious, you know, with your podcast, obviously you kind of explain what you're trying to achieve, but like, do you get pushback? Do you feel like you have an impact? I mean, you do have an impact on me. There's people that I didn't even know until I listened to them on your podcast who are like brilliant anti-imperialist academics. Your podcast is a very good, like, resource in that department. But yeah, I mean, what, like, how do you do anti, you're welcome, but I really do mean that. Like, how do you do anti-imperialist podcasting media in this era when, you know, I think for a lot of people, especially if you look at like people like us, it almost looks like there's so little to gain because all you do is face like smears and libel and people attempting to destroy your reputation.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things. First of all, like what I do and what you do, I think my job is, I feel like I have a very nice luxury, which is I sit back and I just let episodes kind of come to me. Whereas I think you're much more in the trenches of like fighting like daily, like whatever, like I don't even know how you do it, honestly. Like, I watch what you do, I follow you in the sense, like, I don't know how you have the energy. And you also, your platform is much bigger than mine. You have way more, you have hundreds of thousands of followers. I have like 15,000. My show is small compared to yours, much smaller. And with size comes, and I also think being a woman, the gender aspect of all this, with a certain sort of size and with a certain sort of reach, and obviously like added to by the fact of like the gender thing, is that you then solicit all kinds of just insane clown incel rage. And I mean, I've seen it on your feed. I've seen how people attack you. They just like, and like, just get a, like, people who have no life than to sit around and like scream at other people on the internet.
Right.
And I don't know what it is. I think it's the size of my show. I think it's also the I'm not like a guy who says I've been shadow banned, but my Twitter has not grown past 15,000 for months. I used to grow every month.
Twitter stopped growing. Yeah, my Twitter stopped growing a while back. Definitely shadow.
But like, I never see your tweets anymore. Actually, I never see your tweets. So
yeah, I don't think either, unless I go find them.
Yeah,
shadow. algorithm. Yeah. Suppression by algorithm.
Yeah, we're all sort of like, you know, subjects of this, of the algorithm, and we can just be erased. And so part of the lesson I think here is use these platforms, like, you know, use these platforms as much as you can to find like-minded people, interesting people. And they don't even be that have to be like-minded. They just have to offer something that you get to learn. And like, honestly, like I don't even feel like a media person. Like, I guess I do. I do media. I do lots of media. But because like the nature of my show is that it's long form and that it's mostly audio based, and it's kind of like at the whim of my own scheduling. Like I haven't done an episode in like a week and a half. Like, I don't know when I will. I guess this is an episode. I guess this is like, you know what I mean? Like, my show began, my show is kind of more amateur, I would say, than your show. Like, you're a real like working news professional, I would say. Like way more than I am. I feel that way. I mean, I'm a professional, sure, but like there is something called like news, and to run with it, to kind of like ride it out, you have to like go at the pace of the news. And I feel like there are people who can do that well, like you, like Ben Norton, like a ton of people who can kind of ride it out and can kind of like talk and keep on the thing. And like, that takes an energy that I can't muster up. Like, I used to do a ton of episodes every day. I don't know how you do it. Like, I don't know how you, like, the grind of like just even one, three episodes a month. Yeah, like, I honestly don't know how you do it. Just like, it's like that Homer Simpson gif. Maybe your editor can put it in of his head exploding. Like, that's what it feels sometimes just watching our region, let alone the entire world. You just, your head explodes, and you're in Lebanon. You see it every day. You see the crazy things. Like the fact, what they do to that poor little country. Like, I live in the cultural like luxury of the global north, right? Like, it's all very far removed from me. 24-hour
electricity. 24-hour electricity.
Like, even the simplicity of having a fridge that runs 24 hours a day, like, that makes my life so much easier. So the fact that you do so much more, and you do it with the resources that you have, under the struggles. I mean, you wanted to break Lebanon? Look at the kind of people Lebanon creates. Okay, they create people like Rania who fucking effortlessly like have a power outage in their house and just keep rolling with it. Like, it's no problem.
I mean, what are you gonna do?
like if that's not like a metaphor for like the resoluteness of Lebanese people specifically, but I would say people of the region, like, I don't know what is. But I hate the resilience porn. Okay, fine. Like, resilience porn is kind of played out, fine. But if you think denying people like a fridge for 24 hours is going to make them submit to your world, if it's just going to make it okay that they stole Palestine, that like, that they put their bases, that they rape and pillage Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Libya, Afghanistan, that they wage dirty wars, that they suffocate people, they deny dollars, that they build these like economic systems that are exploited, that are built on dollars, and they remove them like it's some kind of like, you know, a little treat that's nothing to them, right? That, oh, we're going to take away Lebanon's like entire financial sector. See you later. We're just going to starve it because they dared put up a bit of resistance. Like, this is the world they want, where the weak are punished for any act of resilience, for any act of resistance. And the strong are defending the world order. They're the noble ones, right? They're defending human rights. I mean, to even look at this world and to comment back on the media environment drives you crazy. So again, the fact that you do it day in, day out, like multiple times a day with different people, like I praise you.
Well, thank
you.
You have
a lot of energy, Rania. You take a lot of bullshit from people that you don't deserve. I never will get anyone any of the fraction of the platform that you have. And that's honestly a big relief, in the sense that with the platform comes so much stress. Like, I like my life now. My life is fine. Just keep it this way, God. It's like Homer Simpson working at the bowling place. Like, I like it. It's good. I make enough money. I'm fine. Like, don't bring me 10,000 new subscribers, because 10,000 new subscribers,
it's a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, like, it brings you hell. Like, I like being small, and so there is an interesting difference.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are all good, fair points. And I do appreciate the compliments and really like the feeling in terms of like respect here and admiration is mutual, because I do love what you do. And I think there's a place for all of it. I like learned so much from the stuff you produce. And I do want to once again encourage everybody to follow East is a Podcast. Check it out. And then also, can you just let people know, like, they can follow you on Twitter? I can link to your Twitter in the description. Is there anything else you want to like shout out?
Yeah, no, I thank you. Thank you, Rania. This was a lot of fun. It took us entirely way too long to make this happen. We'll have you on. Let's talk Lebanon. I want to have like, can you be our unpaid Lebanon correspondent?
I'm happy to be. I'm here.
I will say this. If you were to ask me like, what is like the secret to your success? And well, I'll say this, and this is very corny. It's a very liberal thing to say, but it's community. I managed to create a community of people around my platform, the platform that I built, and I built it with other people's help, right? Like they came on, they gave me their time for free, and they gave me all their years of training. So like, even like, say for instance, the episode, like 3-year-old episode, fantastic episode with Martha Mundi, Yemen scholar, like that episode sits there, gets downloaded every day by at least 4 or 5 different people. Like those 4 or 5 people are learning from, they're benefiting from Martha Mundi's decades of reading and research. And that's just one episode. I have like 300, and there's like 100 behind the paywall, and they're all with interesting different people. And that's, and that culture, I think, of media consumption, I think we should all strive for. I'm not saying you should be like Sini, but on this register, you should be like Sini in the sense that you want an adulterated media world. You don't want a nice, monogamous, eternally cyclical media world of the same group of actors, of the same commentaries, because that's how you get MSNBC
in
a bubble. That's how you get these little morons who all talk to each other, who all just, who in their tiny little provincial minds, see themselves as this arbiters of world global information, when in reality, they know their small little lives in America, they live a small little life in English, and they're exposed to a tiny fraction of the world. But because of the cultural force of American imperialism, and this is what they have complete lockdown on, they will never be a rival, including China and Russia, to the kind of informational power that the US currently controls, that no one will ever rival them. And that's their real weapon, is that their ability to create the world in their own discursive image. So that a dirty war waged by Qatari and Saudi and UAE funded freak jihadists and Salafists and regime changers and mercenary Contras, they get turned into rebels, right? That's the world. And they get to have thousands of hours of media coverage. They get immense amount of sympathy. And this is the story of our media world, that they can just create the world. So if there's anything I can tell people, is that unlock the people in your life or the people you may not even know, and use social media to reach out to them and make connections to people and find people who are interesting, because more likely than not, they'll be happy to share their interests with you and their research. Even if your show has 30 people listening to it, most people are excited to share their work. Most people, like a lot of people, have a lot of like, you know, time constraints. Okay, fine. But like your average academic who has years of training will be happy to answer your questions, and they'll be happy to do it on camera or on audio at least. And they'll be happy that 40 more people are listening to their insights than they were before you reached out. So don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to be an amateur. I was an amateur. I am an amateur still. I almost picked the wrong mic before we started this. Once again, like I almost picked the wrong mic. So I'm still an amateur. And I'm also a producer. I produce other people's shows. And I still almost made that mistake. So we don't need to be a professional. All you have to do is have curiosity and find people who are interested in talking about those curiosities with you and kind of indulging those curiosities. And honestly, it's like the best job in the world. I get to learn and I'm paid to do it.
Yeah, no, it is the best job to be able to do that. But I want to thank you so much for giving me your time. This was such a great conversation. And I hope that we can have you back on in the future.
Thank you, Rania. Thank you for listening. Come check out my show. You'll like it if you like Rania's show.
Thanks for watching, everyone.
If you want to see more progressive anti-imperialist content like this, make sure you hit the subscribe button so you can stay up to date with the latest breakthrough news content. And if you want to support our work and get access to exclusive content, head over to patreon.com/breakthroughnews.